That old familiar feeling is back, pain at the pump. Gasoline costs nearly $3 a gallon in many parts of the country, the highest level since the financial crisis hit in the fall of 2008. And this summer, expect even higher prices. NPR's senior business editor Marilyn Geewax is here with the outlook for summer travel costs. Welcome back, Marilyn.
Hi, Leanne. It's good to be back.
Tell me the bad news. Why are gasoline prices higher?
Well, you know, it seems odd that gas prices have shot up so much. Last year at this time, gasoline was about $2 a gallon, and now it's getting close to about $3 a gallon, and in some places even higher than that. And a good part of that run-up has come in just the last 2 months, which is surprising when you consider that oil supplies have been very abundant this year. We're not yet in the peak driving season, and of course we still have millions and millions of unemployed people who are sitting at home not driving to work every day. So this seems like it should be the right formula for cheap gasoline.
But with fewer drivers on the road and abundant oil supplies, why did the prices go up?
The answer boils down to this. A lot of people around the world are just betting that demand for oil is going to shoot up faster than new supplies can be found in the next year or so. And recently I spoke with Daniel Yergin. You know, he wrote that book, The Prize, the famous book about the history of the oil industry. And he described this price run-up as expectations-driven. He says all over the world, investors are expecting that China and other Asia-Pacific and Middle East region countries, they're going to be using a lot more oil as their economies rebound. Now we have economists who are pretty much estimating that in the coming year, we're going to see oil increase by 1.5 million barrels per day, the demand for it increased. So even if you still have all these Americans unemployed who aren't commuting to work, people in other parts of the world are restarting their factories and their thirst for oil is going to grow.
Is it a given that Americans will be paying more at the pump this summer?
You know, oil prices, they're very volatile, and we've even seen in recent days, you know, they can bump up a little and down a little. But in general, economists are expecting that higher prices are definitely coming our way. There's a federal agency that issued a report just this past week. It predicts that retail gasoline prices definitely will top $3 a gallon nationwide this summer. So that's not great news for vacationers. You know, in July of 2009, gas was about $2.50 a gallon. This July, maybe $3.10 a gallon.
Marilyn, what about airfares? Will they go up too?
Airlines are very much affected by the price of oil. As oil goes up, it sends up jet fuel prices, and that keeps the airlines looking for new sources of revenues. And that's really why you keep seeing more and more of those fees for luggage. Remember, every time you pack those bags, they're heavy, and that makes the plane weigh more, and that means the airline has to burn off more fuel. So they're going to charge you when you bring that suitcase. And earlier this month, we saw a lot of controversy when Spirit Airlines grabbed attention by saying they were going to charge $45 for even a carry-on. Well, this past week, some members of Congress have been talking about finding ways to prohibit those kinds of practices.
So will the airlines just impose more fees, or will the fares go up too?
I think we're going to keep seeing these fees, and also fares are headed up. Travelocity, an online travel site, said that fares for round trips this summer are up 13% compared with last summer. And Priceline, which is another online booking agent, says that by the time we get to the peak of the summer travel season, fares will probably be up about 25%. So the bottom line for travelers is if you really do want to go on a vacation this summer, you better save some more this spring.
NPR Senior Business Editor Marilyn Geewax. Thanks a lot, Marilyn.
Oh, you're welcome.
To robbers, taxicabs may look like hold-up targets that they can flag down on the street. Taxicabs unwittingly pull up to a robber, in fact, and say, "Hop in." Cab drivers have cash in their pockets and their backs are turned, so thieves can climb in, wait for a stop on a dark street, and as Washington, D.C. driver Saeed Khan says, a passenger once did to him.
He pushed me from here, and with the big hunting knife, he put it over here on my...
Under your chin.
Under the chin.
Yeah.
He asked me, "Give me money." I said, "Excuse me, sir, you need money or my blood?"
A recent survey by the University of Illinois at Chicago suggests there may be more crimes against cab drivers in that area, and there have been several attacks in recent weeks across the country, including Grand Rapids, Michigan, Columbia, Georgia, and two cities in California. Just last week, a driver named Richard Temple Jr. was shot and killed in New Orleans, the second cab driver killed in New Orleans in less than 4 months. Many drivers say that in this time of recession, They're working longer hours to support their families, including night shifts, and that exposes them to more danger. Roy Spooner is general manager of the Yellow Cab Company of Washington, D.C.
Where an average driver would work 6 to 8 hours and made a wage to get by, now you're working at about 12 to 14 hours.
And Nathaniel Price, chairman of the D.C. Professional Taxi Cab Drivers Association, says they're looking for fares in neighborhoods with higher crime rates that they used to avoid.
You may have to go and pick up people that you may look at and you may say, this person looks like maybe a threat to my well-being. But on the other end, you said, hey, I need the money.
When we stood in a cab line in front of a D.C. Convention Center area hotel, we found that about half the drivers who worked the night shift seemed to have some kind of crime story about their cab or one or two close friends. The other half were new drivers. A D.C. driver named Mukti Lal explains that each time he's been the victim of a crime, and once he was hijacked, another time he was robbed at knife point of his cash, watch, and cell phone, it's hard to return to work.
What you gonna do, you know, when you have a lot of kids, you raise them, you know, you have no other job, so you have to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a pretty tough time I have, but me and my wife and everybody, we're feeling that way, you know.
D.C. police keep no separate statistics about taxicab crimes. Roy Spooner of Yellow Cab says that many cab attacks never make it into any kind of crime statistics because drivers don't like to call the police, at least after the first time they're robbed.
It's kind of a defensive mode that they seem to operate in because, you know, if you call, you're tied up for 2-3 hours doing police reports, waiting for stuff. And, you know, if I lost $15, let me see if I can make it back in the next few hours. But it's a mentality, but it doesn't fix the problem because they're still exposed.
Teffrey McConan, who's been driving a cab for 5 years, feels there may be another reason why most of the drivers who suffer a crime in their cab may not call the police.
They don't want to tell, even. They shame what happened on them.
Yeah.
And they don't talk to a friend.
Yeah.
Some they do like that, yeah.
A driver named Benyam told us that just a couple of weeks ago he picked up two young men against his better judgment. They said they had to pick up their sister and told him to drive deeper and deeper down a dark alley till one of the men grabbed him from behind and demanded his money.
Then I gave him about $40, $45, I'm not sure. Then the other guy, he put something on my neck. I didn't see what was that, but I knew something very thick. Then, okay, I'll give you anything you want.
But then Mr. Benyam decided to shake up his larcenous passengers.
I stepped on the gas, and I came out from the alley. Then when they see that, they said, they're talking to each other, oh, this guy's crazy. Stop the car. Then finally they opened the door, ran away. I was lucky, you know, because they could kill me.
Police officers came to the scene and drove Mr. Benyam through the neighborhood to see if he could identify anyone on the street as one of his assailants.
So by the time we finished our cruise, and they were trying to take a report from me, you know the funny thing? The knife just came out from my jacket and dropped in front of the policeman.
The knife that they used to help
against
you? Yeah,
they used to kill me. But, you know, one thing make me upset is nobody understands how hard we work in this community. Right now, a recession is going on, and we have to stick on this kind of job, you know.
In many urban areas, taxicab driving is now an occupation for immigrants. Most of the cab drivers with whom we spoke in Washington, D.C. are Ethiopian or Eritrean. Many immigrants say they welcome the chance to be able to work for themselves. They've come from tough places. They're willing to work mean streets. But Teffrey Mekinen says that as he works longer hours for his family, the jobs become another hardship for them to bear.
Especially my wife, always at night time, she called me. You have to come. Don't go far. Always after 10 o'clock, where are you? Why not you come?
Cab drivers in Washington, D.C. talking about how the jobs they have are getting harder on everyone. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Gregory Zuckerman of The Wall Street Journal wrote the book The Greatest Trade Ever, the behind-the-scenes story of how John Paulson defied Wall Street and made financial history. He talked about Paulson here last November, and he joins us again now. Welcome back.
Hi, how you doing, guys?
And the complaint is against Goldman Sachs and against one 31-year-old French banker at Goldman. Is Paulson himself at all vulnerable to an SEC for this?
So far, it doesn't look as like he is. I mean, what's interesting is he basically, just taking a step back, he wanted to bet against as much as he could, and he went to some of these banks. It wasn't just Goldman. He went to Deutsche Bank, Credit Suisse, Bear Stearns, and he said, hey, if you create some of this toxic mortgage product, I can bet against it. So he never had anything to do with the actual sale of these products to investors.
Now, according to the SEC complaint, ACA, a firm that actually selected securities for this investment instrument called Abacus, thought that John Paulson, who was invited in on the selection process, was investing in it, not investing against it. So in early 2007, how widely known was Paulson's interest in shorting the subprime market?
Well, it's a good question. Frankly, on Wall Street, it was pretty well known at that point that he was betting against housing. And not just that, he was sort of dismissed as something of a fool, a little bit of a Cassandra at the time. So one could argue that maybe they should have known that he actually was betting against it, not betting on it. That said, in some of these customized deals where he went to investment banks and had them create it for him, he did buy some of the riskiest tranches, the riskiest slices of this of these mortgage products. So maybe that's the kind of suggestion they were making. Well, yeah, he's buying part of this, although they didn't suggest, didn't tell him the whole story, that he was betting against most of it.
If ACA really didn't know what Paulson was up to, would the investors who eventually bought Abacus, if they'd seen the name John Paulson on it, do you think in 2007 they would have said, whoops, that's a red flag, that guy is actually betting against this house?
You know, it's a great question. That might not have changed anything had they known it. I mean, bottom line is when you make an investment, you make a trade in the street, you often think that somebody's on the other side. And these are big boys. These aren't kind of mom and pops. They're not individual investors. So they would have been a little naive to think that there wasn't anybody sophisticated on the other side. That said, they should have known a little bit more about the process in which Paulson and Company basically went and they said, hey, here's a number of securities that we'd like to be used as the basis for this CDO. And basically they picked the most dangerous.
In her story just now, Yuki Noguchi referred to this email that the Goldman Sachs, Sachs banker sent in January 2007, in which he said, more and more leverage in the system, the whole building's about to collapse any time now, only potential survivor, the fabulous Fab, his name was Fabrice, he's referring to himself, standing in the middle of all these complex, highly leveraged exotic trades that he created without necessarily understanding all of the implications of those monstrosities. What do you think of that as a document in January 2007 on the state of subprime-backed collateralized debt obligations?
Well, he looks like he knows what he's talking about. Also looks like the SEC would argue that he shouldn't have been selling this stuff to investors then if he was so bearish and skeptical about subprime and about housing. I mean, you know, it's a very interesting gray area of law about how much you need to tell investors, especially if they're sophisticated investors. Do you need to tell them that someone's on the other side and someone has worked to make this as dangerous as possible, a debt security? It's a good question.
You mean there's a question as to whether this particular banker was obliged to say, personally, I think this is a bunch of junk and it's all going to collapse.
Exactly. It's not for me to say. That's for the legal minds to figure out. But I think it's a real gray area. Do you need to be telling people this? And the SEC is arguing, yeah, you do.
Gregory Zuckerman. Greg Zuckerman is a senior writer at The Wall Street Journal. He's also author of The Greatest Trade Ever, the behind-the-scenes story of how John Paulson defied Wall Street and made financial history.
The nation's last sardine cannery closed yesterday, the Stinson Seafood Cannery in Prospect Harbor, Maine. Laid off 130 workers. But now they're hoping a new owner will use the plant to process some other kind of seafood. Back in the early 1900s, the state of Maine had as many as 75 plants canning the tiny fish. Ann Mostu visited on one of the final days of this way of life in coastal Maine.
The Stinson Cannery sits on the edge of Prospect Harbor, about three-quarters of the way up Maine's coast. You could smell the fish before you even got in the door. Inside, the sound of jangling cans and the smell of fish were overpowering. Murtress Harrington was used to it.
I'm from Subin, and I've always been a fish packer.
Harrington is 77 years old and first started canning sardines at Stinson Seafood when she was 18.
I started in 50, really, but I didn't stay all them years straight steady because I had children in between.
Harrington wore a hairnet, apron, and gloves as she worked on the assembly line, packing the fish into tiny rectangular cans. Sardines are an oily fish, about 4 inches long, and before they're processed and canned, they're called herring.
Well, I think you have to have a little coordination, getting the fish in the cans right. And see, I've worked on cooked fish, and this is raw fish now. Today, I'm putting steaks in the can, fish, little fish steaks. The girl that's packing with me, she does one can, and she skips a can, and I do that can. That's the way we do the fish.
While it was mostly women packing the fish, men worked at the plant, too, hauling trays and putting them in the steamer, where they were blanched and marinated. The staff of 128 workers churned out about 100,000 cans of sardines a day. Bumblebee Foods, which owns the cannery, attributes the closing to federal regulations that have reduced the catch limits on Atlantic herring. Al West was a fish buyer for the cannery. He says the herring catch limits are half of what they were 6 years ago, and the company could no longer produce enough sardines to keep the plant up and running.
We've been very successful, and we've weathered a lot of storms, but the reduced quota was one that we had no control over.
In this community, there aren't many opportunities for work. Many of the employees had been at the cannery for decades. Murtress Harrington was most concerned about the younger workers.
Well, I think we'll all manage. It's going to be harder on the younger people, I think. At my age, I think I can get by. See, I have my Social Security. No, I don't know. I think it's going to be hard, but hopefully they'll have something come in soon.
Even if there is a buyer, it's unlikely that the cannery will continue to process sardines. But the workers say any jobs will be welcome. For NPR News, I'm Ann Mostu.
This is NPR News.